Hello, Send Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your Send Sounds volunteer, presenting the major news articles from the Monday, May 4th, 2026 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. Before we begin with the headline articles, let's check out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather, a mix of clouds and sun during the morning, will give way to cloudy skies this afternoon. Highs to 82 degrees Fahrenheit, winds southwest at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tonight's weather, cloudy with showers, lows to 62 degrees Fahrenheit, winds southwest winds shifting to southeast at 10 to 15 miles per hour, chance of rain 50%. Tomorrow's forecast predicts partly cloudy skies, a stray shower or thunderstorm is possible, highs to 76 degrees Fahrenheit, winds southwest at 10 to 20 miles per hour. And now from the Arizona Daily Star front page, the first article is titled, Trump Weighs Iran's Proposal. This article was written by Parisa Hafezi and Jacob Babaj of Reuters. Dateline West Palm Beach, U.S. President Donald Trump said that he had yet to review the exact wording of a new Iranian peace proposal, but he was unlikely to accept it because the Iranians had not yet paid a big enough price. Trump's remarks on social media concluded a day in which he publicly mused about the possibilities of restarting airstrikes. The latest mixed signal as he seeks to end the war he launched more than 2 months ago. On Sunday, Israel ordered thousands of Lebanese to leave villages in southern Lebanon. An escalation of war between Israel and Iran's Hezbollah allies that has run in parallel to the Iranian war and could further complicate wider peace efforts. Iran has said talks with Washington cannot resume unless a ceasefire also holds in Lebanon, which Israel invaded in March to attack Hezbollah after the Iranian-backed Lebanese group fired across the border in support of Tehran. Lebanon and Israel agreed a separate truce last month, but fighting has continued, though on a smaller scale. The Israeli military issued an urgent warning on Sunday to residents of 11 towns and villages in Lebanon's south, urging them to evacuate their homes and move at least 1,000 meters or 3,300 feet away to open areas. The military said it was conducting operations against Hezbollah following what it described as a violation of the ceasefire, warning that anyone near Hezbollah fighters or facilities could be at risk. The United States and Israel suspended their bombing campaign against Iran 4 weeks ago, but appear no closer to a deal to end a war that has caused the biggest disruption ever to global energy supplies, roiled global markets, and raised worries about the possibility of a wider global economic downturn. In his post on social media, Trump wrote, "I will soon be reviewing the plan that Iran has just sent to us, but I can't imagine that it would be acceptable in that they have not yet paid a big enough price for what they have done to humanity and the world over the last 47 years. On Saturday, a senior Iranian official had said Iran's proposal would first open shipping in the Strait of Hormuz and end the U.S. blockade of Iran, while leaving talks on Iran's nuclear program for later. Though Trump had already said on Friday that he was not satisfied with the Iranian proposal, he said on Saturday he had yet to hear all the details. They told me about the concept of the deal. They're going to give me the exact wording now, he said. Asked if he might restart strikes on Iran, Trump replied, I don't want to say that. I mean, I can't tell that to a reporter. If they misbehave, if they do something bad, right now we'll see. But it's a possibility that could happen. Iran's proposal to delay talks on nuclear issues until later appears to contradict Washington's repeated demand that Iran give up its stockpile of more than 400 kilograms or 900 pounds of highly enriched uranium as a condition to end the war. The next front page article is titled, GOP Cloud Plays a Big Role in Arizona. This article was written by Mary Jo Pitzel of Capital Media Services, Dateline Phoenix. What's it take to be an effective Arizona lawmaker? Have tenure, hold a key position, or carve out an area of expertise, but most importantly, belong to the majority party. In Arizona, that means the GOP. A lawmaker's party registration helps an outsized role in getting bills passed into law, says a report from the Center for Effective Lawmaking. That's not a surprise given the majority rules in legislative work, but the center's report puts Arizona in a class of its own nationally. Arizona Democrats have been nearly shut out of getting their legislation into law, much more so than other states where the minority party ends up with little to brag about. In the 2023 and 2024 session in Arizona, Republicans saw 442 of their bills signed into law, compared to 20 for the Democrats, even with a Democrat in the governor's seat. This approximately 20-to-1 ratio is significantly out of proportion to the number of seats the parties hold in the chambers, which have been nearly equal and well beyond what is seen in most legislators across the country, the report stated. In the 2023-24 session, Republicans held 48 seats compared to 42 for Democrats. The lopsided results reflect a strong partisanship that resides in the Arizona Capitol, the report noted. The center, a collaboration of Vanderbilt University and the University of Virginia, analyzes the track record of lawmakers in all the states, awarding points to those who successfully guide their bills through the labyrinthine process of reaching the governor's desk and getting signed into law. Heavier weight is given to bills deemed substantial or significant, which means sponsoring lots of specialty license plate bills won't get you a high score. The evaluation results in the legislative effectiveness score that is published after every two-year session. While each state has its own idiosyncrasies, there are some shared traits, said Ellen Wiseman, one of the study's authors. A key common denominator is experience. While there are lots of arguments for term limits, which exist in 16 states, including in modified form in Arizona, Wiseman said the data show the longer a person is in office, the more effective they are. The center's research also showed that developing expertise in a subject can pay off. Lawmakers who focus their policy agendas on one issue tend to be notably more successful, Wiseman said. They've cultivated some background information on that issue and probably have organized their staff around that, he said. And surprisingly, lawmakers who are seen as moderate, which Wiseman cautions is a relative term, fare better. They have track records of working across party lines. Even when you're in the majority party, you tend to do better when you recruit minority members as co-sponsors, he says. Red and blue states aren't very different when it comes to gauging effectiveness. It comes down to the numbers and the simple fact that the majority rules, regardless of who's in charge, Wiseman said. This is not to say that the most effective lawmakers author the most beneficial legislation. The study focuses on the people and the methods that get a policy signed into law, not whether the legislation is deemed good or bad. Arizona's most effective lawmakers, as ranked by the study, echo many of its findings. Representative David Livingston, Republican of Surprise, and Senator John Kavanaugh, Republican Fountain Hills, had the highest scores in the 2023-24 review. Each has been in the legislature for more than a decade, 14 for Livingston and 20 for Kavanaugh. Each chaired the key appropriations committee in their respective chambers, and each had certain areas of emphasis. Leading the Appropriations Committee gives them a leg up. The budget bills carry the name of the chair, which adds up to an automatic 16 bills when successfully passed. Kavanaugh added another factor that he said leads to success, a narrow focus. The leading cause of bill death is overreach, he said. Go too far, too fast, and a bill can quickly die. But a more patient, step-by-step approach can revive a bill. He points to the state's universal school voucher program as the poster child for incremental legislation. It started in 2011 as a program for children with disabilities. In the following years, other categories of eligible children were added, culminating in the expansion to all Arizona students in 2022. The critics claimed it was a slippery slope Kavanaugh set in the original legislation, and they were right. Lawmakers' bills face a treacherous path to get to the governor's desk, he said. Legislation has to clear 21 potential hurdles to get to the finish line, a process he outlines in his book, State Legislatures, an Owner's Manual. That's where experience helps, and not just in knowing how to navigate the technical aspects of the process, he said. Tenured lawmakers tend to have more friends, Kavanaugh said, underscoring the importance of personal relationships and lawmaking. Livingston said bipartisan support is key, especially in the current era of divided government with a Democratic governor and a Republican-controlled legislature. A bill's content, of course, also matters. I don't run too many hot-topic issues, he said, although his sponsorship of pro-Israel bills have drawn heated debate. Livingston said he tends to focus on its niche of pensions and insurance policy issues, keeping the scope limited so they can be easily understood and win votes. Claiming a niche explains the success of other lawmakers ranked by the Center for Effective Lawmaking. A prime example is Representative Gail Griffin, a legislative veteran who dominates on water policy. The center ranked the Hereford Republican second after Livingston in effectiveness in the House. It also recognized her as an Arizona lawmaker who most exceeded expectations by getting substantial wins in six consecutive legislative years. The reason the whole state is not an active management area, that's because of Gail, lobbyist Kevin McDemanis said, referring to restrictions on how much groundwater a given area can pump. She's the queen of water. Griffin chairs the House committee that deals with water legislation and plays a vital gatekeeper role on which bills get a hearing and which get sidelined. There's another power of chairmanship, an agreement with their counterpart in the opposite chamber to advance each other's Bill, said Mike Hayner, a lobbyist who has spent years at the Capitol. You want some courtesy of your bills to being heard, he explained. Such a relationship can boost the chances of a chair's bills getting to the finish line. Although most of the high-scoring lawmakers are committee chairs, there are exceptions. Representative Selena Bliss ranked as the third most effective House lawmaker in her freshman term, which links to her background as a nurse as well as a voice for rural Arizona. She's a Republican from Prescott. The report ranked the Democrats separately from the Republicans, given the partisan disparity in getting a bill heard. The top three in the House were all three-term veterans, which speaks to the value of tenure. One of those lawmakers, former Representative Jennifer Longden of Phoenix, said there's more to being effective than getting a bill signed into law, regardless of the study's focus. Being a minority member, that may not be the strongest and most effective measure, she said. I think learning how to move effectively behind the scenes is just as important. Lawmakers' overall performance can also be gauged by how much time they spend meeting with constituents, helping them navigate government, and explaining what is happening at the Capitol, she said. Plus, there is no metric for measuring how much a minority party member might have influenced legislation. There are lawmakers whose names are lost to history who helped shape important policies, even if their name is not on the bill, Longden said. Our next front page article is titled GOP Governors Seek New Maps After SCOTUS Ruling. This article was written by Joseph Axe of Reuters. The Republican governor of Alabama, South Carolina, and Tennessee made clear they will try to push through congressional maps more favorable to their party ahead of November's midterm elections, fallout from the U.S. Supreme Court seismic voting rights ruling Wednesday. Meanwhile, Democratic voters, civil rights groups, and a Democratic candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives filed lawsuits challenging Republican Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry's decision to suspend his state's congressional primary elections and pursue a new map. Landry on Thursday proposed the scheduled May 16th primary vote to give law to give state lawmakers time to draw a new map that would dismantle at least one Democratic-held majority black U.S. House district after the Supreme Court found the current map unconstitutional. Early voting had been set to begin Saturday. President Donald Trump's fellow Republicans are fighting to maintain their control of the House as well as the Senate in the midterm elections. The court's decision, which severely weakened the landmark Voting Rights Act passed in 1965, came amid a national fight over redistricting. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey announced Friday that she called a special legislative session starting Monday so lawmakers could consider postponing the May 19th primary election in the hope that the Supreme Court will permit the state to use a different map. Alabama, where black voters make up a quarter of the electorate, currently uses a court-ordered map that includes two majority black districts out of seven, both held by black Democrats. After the Supreme Court's decision, the state immediately filed emergency motions asking the court to allow it to revert to an older map with only a single majority black district. Black voters tend to support Democratic candidates. I remain hopeful Alabama will receive a favorable outcome from the U.S. Supreme Court, Ivey said in a statement. Republican Tennessee Governor Bill Lee also called a special legislative session Friday, which will begin Tuesday, to review the state's congressional map. He said in a statement that officials must ensure our congressional district accurately reflect the will of Tennessee's voters. Republican South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster suggested he would like his state's legislature to consider a new map. South Carolina's lone Democratic seat, a majority black district that includes parts of the capital, Columbia, is represented by longtime U.S. Representative Jim Clyburn. The next front page article is titled, Less Water, More Lawsuits. This article was written by Tony Davis of the Arizona Daily Star. The federal government's move to slash releases of Colorado River water from Lake Powell to Lake Mead will trigger a violation of a century-old legal agreement requiring minimum releases to Mead in the eyes of Arizona and two other states that receive the water. It isn't clear whether the reduced water releases will mean those three states will soon start getting less water out of Mead than they expected. That would set off sudden cutbacks in river water deliveries to the Central Arizona Project, Yuma area farmers, and large Southern California water users. Or will the feds maintain their current releases from Lake Mead to the states and draw down the already depleted lake further? Under its most recent plan for the river, announced last month, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation will reduce releases from Powell to Mead by about 20% this year. That amounts to a reduction of 1.48 million acre-feet to be released from an original planned release of 7.48 million acre-feet. The 1.48 million acre-feet is somewhat less than the total amount of water that the Central Arizona Project Canal System delivers from the river to Phoenix and Tucson over 2 years. These issues have short-term and long-term implications for water users, including Tucson and three lower Colorado River Basin states of Arizona, Nevada, and California. Tucson water gets most of its current drinking water from CAP water that it recharges into a local aquifer and pumps back out again. If water releases from the four upper basin states to the lower basin states end up averaging less than the legal minimum levels for releases over a decade, Arizona and the lower basin states could very well take the upper basin states and the federal government to court. A lawsuit would allege that the releases violate the minimums set by the 1922 Colorado River Compact that all seven states agreed to. The upper basin states are Wyoming, New Mexico, Utah, and Colorado. More immediately, if water releases from Powell fall below what's legally required under the compact, it will mean that until the legal issue is settled, which would likely take years, Arizona and the other lower basin states will get even less water out of Lake Mead than they otherwise would have received. That's even after taking into account the cuts they'll have to swallow in water use from any future actions by reclamation to cut water use over 20 years. Separately, if water releases from Lake Mead are cut immediately, along with the releases from Powell to Mead, that will mean Arizona, California, and Nevada will have to start taking cuts in their river water deliveries immediately or very soon. But if releases from Mead aren't cut, the reservoir would keep declining further than it already has fallen, raising concern about its long-term health and the possibility it will hit dead pool levels at which no water could be released at all. If future years are dry like this one, I hate to use the phrase new normal, but what we're seeing now could be the new normal, said Eric Kuhn, an author and former general manager for a Colorado water district. Here are the details on both issues. The agreement reached by all seven river basin states in 1922 requires the upper basin states to ensure that 75 million acre-feet of Colorado River is delivered to the lower basin states over a decade. In 1944, the U.S. and Mexico agreed to a treaty obligating this country to allow another 1.5 million acre-feet of river water to flow into that country every year. That boosted the upper basin's 10-year water delivery obligation to 82.5 million acre-feet, the lower basin states have said. Until now, the upper basin states have managed to meet the 82.5 million acre-foot delivery release level, and then some, every decade. But this year's plans to cut releases from Powell to Mead by 20% will reduce the most recent 10-year total of water deliveries to 81.3 million, said Kuhn, who has tracked compact compliance issues over years. This failure to comply with the bedrock agreement among the seven Colorado states is itself a serious development that Arizona will assess and will respond to accordingly in time, the Arizona Department of Water Resources said after Reclamation announced its plans in April to cut releases from Powell to Mead. ADWR made no explicit threat to sue in that statement, but state officials have made it clear they're prepared to sue. They have agreed to pay the high-powered New York City-based global law firm Sullivan & Cromwell $3 million to fight the compact issue in court if necessary. We have rights in the compact that require the upper basin to release 75 million acre-feet over 20 years, plus half the Mexican treaty obligation. That keeps the lower basin in business, said Terry Goddard, president of the Central Arizona Projects Governing Board and a former Arizona Attorney General. Otherwise, they get the whole amount, said Goddard, referring to the upper basin states. Those are the rules we've lived with for 100 years, and they're thumbing their nose at them. A long-term solution that doesn't recognize our rights under the Colorado River Compact is not a solution. We need to stand firm on that. That's Arizona's birthright, Goddard said. The upper basin states, however, have said they don't consider themselves legally bound to deliver one half of the water needed to meet the Mexican treaty obligations. They also say the 1922 compact doesn't require them to deliver a minimum amount of water. It requires them not to deplete so much water that deliveries fall below a minimum level. And it's human-caused climate change, not their actions, that are depleting the river, they say. But if the river flows keep getting drier and the river's reservoir keep dropping, things could get to a point where the river carries so little water that the compact issue becomes irrelevant, said Kuhn. One reason is that the upper basin states are now using only 4 million acre-feet a year, not counting evaporation. That's far less than the states are legally allowed to take under the compact, he said. But 2 million of that is covered by what is known as present perfected rights, a term used to describe water rights on the river that are older than the 1922 compact, said Kuhn. He calls those rights legally untouchable. If the river gets low enough that only 2 million acre-feet are available for the upper basin states, It's very unlikely that the upper basin wouldn't be allowed to use that water due to compact obligations, Kuhn said. A court might have a different opinion, but I think it's pretty commonly accepted, said Kuhn, of the legal validity of these rights. Every year, Lake Mead sends downstream water that people in Tucson and Phoenix drink, water that irrigates crops in the Yuma area and Southern California's Imperial Valley, and water that serves millions of Southern California residents. But with releases to Lake Mead due for a hefty cut, the Star has been unable to get authoritative answers from key state and federal agencies on how that cut will affect water deliveries to downstream users such as Tucson and Phoenix. On April 20th, 3 days after the Bureau of Reclamation announced it would be cutting water releases from Powell to Mead, the Star asked Reclamation whether it would then release less water from Mead to the lower basin, how much will releases be reduced, and when the Bureau will announce the reduced releases. At this time, we do not have any additional comments to share, replied Bureau spokeswoman Becky Bryant. Beyond the news release, the agency had issued announcing the cuts in releases to Mead and a related plan to release more water into Lake Powell from the upstream Flaming Gorge Reservoir. Asked the same question by the Star around the same time, Arizona Department of Water Resources spokesman Doug McKitchen said, "We can't speculate on how individual users may or may not be affected at this point. However, we can say the reduced delivery of only 6 million acre-feet from Lake Powell to Lake Mead may require water use reductions by Arizona water users," he said. The reduction in water releases from Powell to Mead will knock Mead's water level down 20 feet, said Bronson Mack, a Southern Nevada Water Authority spokesman. He said he based that estimate on information he received in a recent Bureau of Reclamation webinar. A 20-foot drop in Lake Mead could push the lake below the 1,035-foot level, at which Hoover Dam's power generation would be cut 70% from what it generated in 2000 by as early as June. By fall 2027, the lake could fall far enough that a 20-foot decline would drop Mead as low as 1,005 feet, when Reclamation has said it wants to keep Mead at 1,000 feet or above, if at all possible. At 950 feet at Mead, Hoover would be unable to generate any electricity. At 895 feet, Mead would hit deadpool, at which no water could be released. Because of the risks to the reservoir from additional declines, former Reclamation official David Wegener said he expects the Bureau will ultimately reduce releases from Mead, but he can't say when. I suspect they are going to wait till a little bit later in the year to see how much they have, said Wegener, who sits on the National Academy of Sciences Advisory Board. You want to know how bad off it really is? Get the data and then make the decision. But CAP Board President Goddard said he doesn't expect any immediate cuts in Lake Mead releases. He said Reclamation has contracts with the lower basin water users to deliver a specified amount of water through the end of 2026, and he believes the amount of river water under its contract to deliver is 7.48 million acre-feet. The Bureau could well release the amount of water lower basin states are expecting, even if that lowers Mead below the level at which its water will be high enough to flow into the intakes leading to Hoover Dam's turbines, thereby severely restricting its ability to generate electricity, he said. Right now, the first demand for the Bureau is to satisfy has got to be water, Goddard said. Asked if the low reservoir levels and the warm, dry weather have put officials in a pinch, he said, "Pinch is the nicest word you could use. We're in a hell of a pinch. Someone said we were waiting for Noah's flood, but El Nino will do," said Goddard, referring to numerous scientists' forecasts that the coming fall and winter will bring El Nino conditions to the world conditions that often mean cooler, wet weather in the Southwest. Now we'll pause to remind you that you are listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. Now we'll turn to the page of the Tucson and Region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles there. The title of the first article is 4-Day Schedule Set for PV High. This article was written by Victoria Gonzalez of the Arizona Sonoran News. The Tucson Unified School District Governing Board has unanimously approved a one-year pilot program for a 4-day school week at Palo Verde High School. Palo Verde students in the fall will transition to attending school from 8:10 a.m. to 4:10 p.m., Mondays through Thursdays instead of the traditional 5-day schedule. The school will be open on Fridays for students to get tutoring from teachers and to participate in food service. At Tuesday's TUSD board meeting, students, teachers, and parents were optimistic about the change. "Our teachers feel so strongly about this policy, not only for our own lesson preparation needs and work-life balance, but also because we believe that this pilot is a benefit to our students and their lives," Palo Verde teacher Brenda Camping told the board. "There are so many situations in which Fridays are dedicated to catching up, or sometimes even just a little bit more time to relax and be with their families, which would change these kids' lives for the better." Tucson is the latest district to consider adopting a 4-day class schedule, a change several districts statewide began during the pandemic. Several of those districts, including Casa Grande Elementary School District, made the move permanent with the 2023-24 school year. Liberty and Cartwright Elementary School Districts were the largest in the Phoenix area to adopt the 4-day school week, but Cartwright and Phoenix West Valley announced in January that it would return to the traditional 5-day week beginning in the fall. Cartwright District Executive Director of Public Relations Victor Hugo Rodriguez said the district made the decision after seeing state test scores decline. "According to state documents, the district saw significant test scores decline in all major subjects, including language, arts, math, and reading. We realized that a traditional week would be better for our students because they would be able to spend more time with their teachers, more time learning, and this would be better for them when they transition to high school," Rodriguez said. The Cartwright District, which serves students from preschool through 8th grade, had 13,375 students enrolled in the 2024-25 school year, with 19% of students achieving English language proficiency. That was a drop from the 23% proficiency in the 2018-19, when district enrollment was 16,035. The district's math proficiency also declined from 21% in 2018-19 to 19% in 2024-25, according to Arizona school report cards. The Tucson board said test scores and attendance are driving reasons it voted to approve the Palo Alto pilot program. Palo Verde Principal Eric Brock told the board that test scores will be among the criteria he will consider to determine if the 4-day schedule is successful. The next article is titled, "Judge Rejects Election Plan for Vote Centers in Pinal." This article was written by Ronald J. Hansen of the Arizona Republic. A judge has struck down Arizona Secretary of State Adrian Fonte's election plan that included broad vote centers in Pinal County, ruling that the county never voted to conduct its elections that way, and it could make voting harder on the disabled there. The May 1st ruling by Maricopa County Superior Court Judge Scott Blaney was intended to provide a legal answer to the long simmering dispute over Fonte's election procedures manual, and leave time for an expected appeal before the state's July primary elections. Blaney also ruled against Fontes on a provision of the statewide election manual that required voting devices to include all ballot styles in the county, something that Pinal County judge ruled was improper in 2024 as well. Blaney held that Fonte's powers of Secretary of State don't extend to the details that involve how counties use and tally special voting equipment intended for the handicapped. Fontes maintained that the system he called for accommodates voter needs more fully, including the handicapped. The judge ordered Pinal County to provide a tally of its legal expenses in the matter, which Fonte's office would owe. Jeffrey McClure, the chair of the entirely Republican Board of Supervisors, said, "State law has always given county boards control over the style of voting, not the Secretary of State. Pinal County has always utilized the precinct-based voting model, and our voters tell us they want to keep it that way, primarily for reasons of security and control," he said in a statement. Pinal County Recorder Dana Lewis, a Republican, said Blaney's blocked Fonte's from usurping the county's powers. "The court found that we have contended that the Elections Procedures Manual overstepped its bounds. The decision reaffirmed that remaining a precinct-based system is a local county decision and that it is not within the Secretary's authority to create de facto voting centers." In a statement, Kelly Jones, a Fonte spokeswoman, called the ruling a limited setback. "Our office is disappointed that judges' rulings will make it harder for voters with a disability to vote in Pinal County than in other county in Arizona," she said. "However, while our office looks to its next steps, we recognize that this ruling affects only one very small provision in a manual that gives the counties very clear guidance on election administration issues." Jones said the procedures manual came about in collaboration with county recorders and election directors and has the support of Attorney General Chris Mays and Governor Katie Hobbs. In siding with the Pinal County Board of Supervisors, Blaney held that the board's preferred polling place election system can offer a more efficient process for voters. "There are several advantages to using a polling place model," Blaney wrote. "For instance, precinct-style voting helps to distribute voters more evenly among polling places and thus reduces wait times. Precincts typically only offer ballots that reflect the specific races that only residents in that area are able to vote on. Vote centers have more types of ballots and allow voters to vote in any such location countywide, though they still cannot vote in races outside where they reside. Fontes, a Democrat, used voting centers in Maricopa County when he was the county recorder. His preferred vote centers would require Pinal County officials to make time-intensive software changes to offer all possible ballots within the county at every location and would undermine the county's efforts to educate the public about where they can properly vote, Blaney ruled. "It specifically affects what are known as accessible voting devices, or AVDs, which are required for the handicap under the Federal Help America Vote Act. Processes that would direct a wider usage of AVDs threaten to disenfranchise disabled voters by creating long lines at AVD machines," Blaney wrote. "Even if disabled voters are not disenfranchised, these voters justifiably express frustration when non-disabled individuals use devices like AVDs that are specifically designed for disabled persons." The Blaney ruling comes days after Fonte scored a significant legal win over the U.S. Justice Department in its efforts to acquire Arizona's voter information files. A federal judge held that the government had not put forth any valid reason for such a broad request. It made Arizona the sixth state to win in challenging the Justice Department's search for voter information. The next article is titled, Inmate Dies After Many Hurt in Big Prison Fight. This article was written by Jose R. Gonzalez of the Arizona Republic. An inmate has died following a large fight at an Arizona prison that also left at least nine others hospitalized, though officials have declined to classify the incident as a riot. Christopher John Wagner, 45, was pronounced dead the morning of May 2nd at Dignity Health Chandler Regional Medical Center after being hospitalized in critical condition, according to the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry. Wagner was injured April 26 during a fight among inmates at the Iman Complex Running Unit in Florence, and his death is being investigated as a homicide, the department said. Two inmates remain hospitalized and were in stable condition, the department said May 2nd. There were about 10 inmates hospitalized as of April 28th, according to Corrections Director Ryan Thornell. Few details have been released about the incident that led to Wagner's death, as state officials had not provided an exact number of people involved as of April 29th. Thornell described it as a sizable fight among multiple inmates and said it did not meet the definition of a riot because staff and property were not targeted. Correctional officers described the incident as a full-blown riot involving more than 100 people, said Carlos Garcia, executive director of the Arizona Correctional Peace Officers Association. Garcia added that the number of injured might be higher than reported, than the reported 10 hospitalized, and said one person suffered severe brain injuries. The incident was gang-related, beginning in the kitchen before spreading to other areas, according to Thornell. Garcia suggested the violence may be linked to higher-risk inmates being housed in lower security units, though Thornell said those involved were placed appropriately. Wagner was sentenced on February 2021 for offenses in Pinal County, receiving 10 years for theft of a means of transportation and 2.5 years for dangerous drug violation, according to prison records. It was not immediately clear whether the sentences were to run consecutively or concurrently. The next article is titled Arizona Helps Moon Mission. This article was written by Tyler Mitchell of Cronkite News Service. Dateline Tempe. Even as the world celebrated the success of the Artemis II mission, researchers in Arizona were already looking ahead to Artemis III. NASA's next mission, Artemis III, aims to help land astronauts on the lunar surface for the first time since the Apollo era. The long-term goal is to establish a sustained presence on the moon. NASA will disclose more information on the Artemis III mission design and crew closer to the 2027 launch. Artemis III mission, now in 2027, will be designed to test out systems and operational capabilities in low Earth orbit to prepare for an Artemis IV landing in 2028, according to a statement by NASA. It is part of NASA's goal of returning astronauts to the moon and achieving an enduring presence there. It is really our first steps back to the landing on the moon again, to setting up a base on the moon and to having a permanent human presence on another world, said Laurie Lation, former NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory director who's now a professor at Arizona State University. Artemis II marked the first crewed trip around the moon in more than 50 years, traveling 252,756 miles from Earth, surpassing the record for human spaceflight's farthest distance of 248,655 miles, or rather 248,655 miles previously set by the Apollo 13 mission in 1970, according to NASA. Part of that historic effort was tied to work happening right here in Arizona, from training astronauts to supporting mission control and developing new technology. ASU is playing a growing role in the future of space exploration. Kelsey Young, an ASU graduate, served as a lead scientist in mission control, becoming part of a new generation helping guide deep space missions from Earth. She was the science flight operations lead, according to NASA. Young's research focuses on the integration of science into human exploration. She also focuses on science operations with NASA's Artemis campaign as the science flight operations lead and in several other capacities, according to NASA. Young also conducts fieldwork in both impact-catered, cratered, and volcanic terrains, like Arizona's desert landscape. Parts of Arizona provide conditions similar to a lunar surface, offering astronauts a hands-on experience navigating unfamiliar environments. Sites like Meteor Crater in northern Arizona and Cinder Lake, created by a massive meteor impact tens of thousands of years ago, give astronauts and researchers a rare opportunity to train in landscapes that mirror the moon's rocky surface, according to the company that runs the site. We've been training astronauts here on some of our more moon-like landscapes since back in the Apollo days, Leshin said. The university has contributed to more than 25 missions across the solar system, with instruments currently operating around Earth, Mars, the Moon, and asteroids. It is also one of only a handful of universities in the country capable of building interplanetary spacecraft, according to a 2020 ASU News article. Leshin says Artemis II astronauts also worked with ASU facility to better understand geology. The Artemis II mission lasted 10 days, starting April 1st. The crew successfully splashed down in the Pacific Ocean after completing the mission, marking a major milestone in the NASA program. For researchers like Leshin, missions like Artemis II are just the beginning. ASU researchers are also contributing to the technology that makes future missions possible. We have students working on superconducting detectors that help perceive optical signals from missions like Artemis, said ASU professor Philip Moskov. That kind of work is critical for communications and data collection in deep space. For Arizona researchers and students, that means their work will continue to shape what comes next. From the desert landscapes where astronauts train to the labs developing the tools that guide them. We are literally becoming a multi-planet species with Artemis II, Leshin said. We are paving the way for that. The title of our next article is Senator Gallego Calls for More Aid to Ukraine. This article was written by Ronald J. Hansen of the Arizona Republic. America seemingly can't fully back Ukraine in its war with Russia as long as President Donald Trump favors the Kremlin, Senator Ruben Gallego and a retiring House Republican said. Speaking at the McCain Institute Sedona Forum on May 2nd, Gallego, Democrat of Arizona, and Representative Don Bacon, Republican of Nebraska, voiced a longstanding bipartisan frustration that the U.S. has played too small a role in a war many see as vital to American interests in checking Russia. I think there was a problem in the Biden administration where they didn't know if Ukraine could win and what a victory would look like, said Gallego, who was a member of the House Armed Services Committee before joining the Senate in 2025. And then you have a problem with this administration that I don't think wants Ukraine to win. This is my personal opinion. Ukraine is winning right now, and we should make the decisions to make sure that happens. Bacon, who is a member of the House Armed Services Committee, noted that polling shows 70% of Americans support Ukraine in that war. America has moral clarity on this, Bacon said. I can't figure out why the White House doesn't. Gallego said he is troubled that the Trump administration is applying pressure to Ukraine to accept what he called a bad peace deal. That, he predicted, would not be honored by Russia and would really abuse the collapse of American leadership around the world. Taiwan, Gallego said, would feel pressure to strike some type of deal with mainland China after seeing the U.S. follow Kiev to bend to Moscow. Closer to Ukraine, Moldova, and the Baltic states could be the next targets of Russian aggression, he said. Bacon traces the poor U.S. response in Ukraine back to President Barack Obama and Joe Biden, who were weak when Russian President Vladimir Putin entered Ukraine in 2014 and again in 2022. Trump, Bacon said, did a lot better in his first term on Ukraine, but he's totally failing right now. There is a moral blind spot here. I don't understand it, Bacon said. It's pretty clear the president and his team favor Putin. I think that's just a fact. The panel discussion included former Kurt Volker, the former U.S. ambassador to NATO, and the founding executive director of the Institute at Arizona State University. We need to see what the stakes are. It is the fight of all of our generations, of freedom versus tyranny, and we are not doing our part, he said. I would argue that that has been through President Obama, President Biden, President Trump. We are still not living up to this, but I would say that it's not too late. Volker has played several roles in Ukraine, most notably when he was among those encouraging Trump in his first term to provide the $400 million in military support to Ukraine that Congress had authorized. In a 2019 phone call with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Trump tried to condition that aid on the announcement of an investigation of Biden and his son's work with the Ukrainian energy concern. The public revelation of that conversation led to Trump's first impeachment. Evelyn Farkas, the Institute's current executive director and the deputy assistant secretary of defense for the Ukrainian region in the Obama administration, said U.S. aid to Ukraine has consistently provided too late, too little. On the other side of the equation, the Russians are incredibly weak. We have a huge opportunity right now, she said. America's international allies in Europe and Asia have started to build up their militaries in response to concerns that the United States is no longer a reliable partner, Farkas said. We tell them, don't give up on us, don't give up on us entirely. I do think that our allies understand that there is a debate here in the United States. There is a political struggle going on about the future of our alliances. Hopefully they will stay and wait for us. The discussion was part of the conference themed around challenges to the American dominance. Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, referenced some of the same ideas as a panel May 1st during his remarks at the conference. We're also entering a new era that will test our leadership in different ways, he said, citing artificial intelligence and competition from China as examples. Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine continues to test the strength of democratic alliances and the principle that sovereign nations have the right to choose their own destiny and their own future, Kelly said. Through all of this, our allies don't view us the same way they used to. It's not an exaggeration. They're asking if we're the reliable partners that they have known. And now, several important news articles from around the nation and the world. The first article is titled, Gorsuch Leaks a Concern. This article was written by Reuters. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch expressed unease on Sunday concerning the continuing leaks of internal deliberations at the nation's highest judicial body, citing the need for the nine justices to be able to engage in candid conversations. Gorsuch, a member of the court's 6-3 conservative majority, made his comments in the aftermath of publication by the New York Times last month of leaked memos relating to a Supreme Court action in 2016 blocking Democratic President Barack Obama's Clean Power Plan. It was the latest in a number of leaks involving the court in recent years. We want some transparency, but we also have to leave room for candid conversations and deliberations with one another. Gorsuch appointed to the court in 2017 by Republican President Donald Trump, said on the Fox News Sunday program. Gorsuch pointed to the availability of live audio of the court's oral arguments as an example of transparency. But do we need time to actually talk quietly with one another to find those places where we can reach agreement? Yeah, we do, Gorsuch said. The court has dramatically increased use of its so-called emergency docket also called the shadow docket, handing Trump repeated wins since he returned to office last year that allowed him to pursue the aggressive and sometimes novel uses of executive authority while challenges played out in lower courts. The emergency docket power was the subject of the leaked memos published in the New York Times. The most prominent leak occurred in 2022 when the news outlet Politico published a draft of the Supreme Court's blockbuster ruling overturning the 1973 Roe v. Wade landmark that had legalized abortion nationwide weeks before the decision was formally issued. Asked whether the leaks impact the court's role or the public's confidence in it as an institution, Gorsuch said, "The public can listen to arguments and read the court's opinions. Everything that I think about the case is there on the printed page for anybody to read if they so choose," Gorsuch said. Though the court typically issues full opinions in its regular cases, after hearing arguments and deliberating for months, its emergency decisions frequently are delivered quickly, with little or no reasoning provided. Gorsuch made his comments while promoting his new children's book, Heroes of 1776, The Story of the Declaration of Independence. The book coincides with the U.S. celebrations of the 250th anniversary of its independence from Britain in July. Gorsuch and the other conservative justices continue to move American law sharply to the right. Last week, Gorsuch joined the other conservative justices in gutting a key provision of the Voting Rights Act, making it harder for minorities to challenge electoral maps as racially discriminatory under the pivotal civil rights law. Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star, the May 4th, 2026 edition. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.